This is the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, editor-in-chief of Feminem. Now, before we start, just a quick friendly reminder that the application is open to be a speaker at Fix 20. So get those applications in soon. They are due December 31st. Next up on our Fix 19 content, we have a fantastic talk from Dr. Hannah Janeway. She's currently an International and Domestic Health Equity and Leadership Fellow at UCLA. Her current work is focused on vulnerable populations at the U.S.-Mexico border and social justice. She delivered a powerful Fix 19 talk entitled, You Are More Powerful Than You Think. Enjoy.
The sound was deafening. Moments earlier, two police officers struggled with an agitated patient. It was different than usual. Not his level of agitation, but their response to it. They were using tasers, and I was screaming, not at his neck, not at his neck. And then they were on top of him. He was flailing, lost in his own confusion. He was face down on the ground, small, unarmed, and I kept thinking, at any moment, our normal processes will kick into gear, chemical and physical restraint. But instead, that deafening noise rang out through the air. A single gunshot. He stopped moving immediately, his vigor reduced to an involuntary stillness. But the police continued, knees into his back, cuffs under his hands, and I'm looking at him, willing him to move. But he doesn't. There's a rush to the trauma bay, and the police won't uncuff him at first, and I keep thinking we're in a level one trauma center, we can save him. But his heart won't start beating again, not with anything that we do. He was dead. This is Ruben Herrera, or Junior, as his family called him, and he was only 26 years old. And I will not leave him nameless or sweep his story under the rug like the police and hospital did. And he is not the first person to be shot by the police in our hospitals, our spaces. The same year Ruben was killed, Alan Peon, the brother of a resident physician here in New York City, was shot in the chest by an off-duty police officer. That case drew national attention in an article in the New York Times documenting the frequency to which this was occurring. Shortly after the event, administrators descended and the police pressed us for statements. Then the emails started to come. The message was very clear. Don't talk to your friends, your family, or even your colleagues. They cited HIPAA, and then they cleanly, quickly, and deliberately swept the matter under the rug. And this is where I get to my story. I wish it could be Ruben's story, but they stole that from him the night that they killed him. So I'm left with my truth to do him justice. And my question for myself was, what do you actually do in a situation like this? After all, I was an intern, and this was my first month in the emergency department. In my mind, there was a clear connection between Ruben's death, the shooting of an unarmed Latino patient face down on the hard ground, and the many police shootings of people of color that were finally garnering national outrage. A recent study showed that the median probability of being black or Latino and shot unarmed was 3.5 and 1.6 times that of their white counterparts. As emergency physicians, we're first responders. We intubate devastating subarachnoids, we screen for interpersonal violence, and we deliver bad news every day. Yet we also have an inside lens into bias, discrimination, and police violence, all of which are symptoms of structural racism and other forms of societal inequalities that increase mortality and decrease overall health. And yet, even though we can talk very seamlessly and very easily about whether or not we should use TPA when treating a stroke, we don't talk very much with one another or in academic discourse about racism. A 2016 article in the New England Journal of Medicine reported that over the prior 11 years, only 14 articles in that journal mentioned the word racism at all. And while we all know that these things that happen cause this inequality, none of us tend to speak out about it. Our lack of engagement, both individually and collectively, is in stark contrast to the role that we play in society as safety nets for the population, where we disproportionately serve the most under-resourced and vulnerable populations. Isn't it our job to be their doctors, to assure them that we are there to serve and protect them? When I first decided to speak at FIX about this topic, I didn't know which of the many messages to convey. But I quickly realized that my job wasn't necessarily to break down structural racism for you here, but instead to talk to you guys about how to stop us from continuing to be silent on injustices, big or small, that we see around us daily. So here I was, an intern, essentially being told to be silent. I was told, no, we do not need to release a statement to the community, have a conversation about police violence, or study why something that should never occur in the confines of the hospital walls did, because technically, when the patient was shot in the middle of our emergency department, he already had his discharge paperwork. I felt I had only two choices: shut the fuck up, or do what everyone around me told me would essentially be career suicide, and directly disobey my program director, my chair, and the entire administration. However, I also knew something that I had learned as a queer person a long time ago, which is that there is nothing worse than knowing something so deeply and being silenced into a closet of your and society's making. So I chose the career suicide route. And I started thinking, how does one create power from the bottom of the medical hierarchy? Now, this goes out to trainees in particular, but I think it applies to anyone who's not like the boss, who feels silenced even a little bit, who feels like hurling proverbial Molotov cocktails will forever damage them and their career, and who feels isolated and alone in this. I know that I did. But what I want to tell you, and what I learned, is that you are more powerful than you think you are. When we are faced with an injustice, big or small, we have two choices: speech or silence. How do we motivate ourselves and other physicians to choose speech? My fellow emergency medicine residents, for the most part, were not in my corner, and neither was my leadership. Social scientists have identified two factors pertaining to speech that predominate in hierarchical situations. Will it make a difference, and will I be safe when I speak up? Speech is inherently risky because it challenges the status quo, and fear tends to mediate between both of these factors. Yet we all have the ability to choose speech over silence by dealing with and utilizing our fear. This is why we should dismiss our fears, and what I learned in the process of doing just that. One, as physicians, people listen to us. I like still find this very surprising, but it's true. And this is a tremendous privilege, but it is also a responsibility. As clinicians and researchers, we yield power and privilege to dismantle structural racism and other forms of societal inequities. Even as a resident, you have so much more of a voice than many of the people you serve, and you can use that voice to give back power and agency. Two, you have to find your allies. While I was being silenced in the ED, I found mine in another department, in the Department of Family Medicine. They supported me, and they introduced me to the resident union, CIR, who voted to support a petition that we wrote for reform. These strategic alliances made my message, which became our collective message, stronger. And three, you are gonna feel isolated and alone. This was probably the hardest part. I faced retaliation and threats. Senior residents and even faculty and leadership attempted to bully me every day for months. The few residents who did support me and other people, most of them were unwilling to do so publicly, even though they had more status and privilege than I did. After witnessing a particularly bad day of this, an off-service resident said to me, "Dude, why don't you just switch residency programs? This is awful." But what I learned about myself in the process, and what was essential for me overcoming my fear, was this: perspective. I knew that what I was experiencing was 1/1000th of what people of color experience every day in this country as a consequence of racism. If I had been on the floor that day, I don't think I would have been shot. But besides that, I don't face any of the microaggressions that people of color do in this country, and I certainly shouldn't feel sorry for myself for getting bullied, for trying to fight for a world in which those no longer exist. Responsibility. And I know this is related, but I knew that this risk I was taking was an inherent part of my responsibility as a doctor and as a person of privilege in the fight for social justice and equity. And certitude. I knew what I was doing was right. It aligned with my moral and ethical framework and for the vision I hope to create in this world. They could try to bully me, even try to make me feel miserable, but they couldn't make me feel badly about what I was doing. At the most basic level, I was just being a patient advocate. But it was more than that. I was using my privilege in the fight for social justice. And this is what got me beyond fear. And that is why I'm imploring each and every one of you out there who's in a position of power to support people below you when they speak up, even if you don't agree with them. Voice is what has driven innovation and change for centuries. And every study I looked at showed that if an employee viewed their supervisor as easily approachable, they'd be much more likely to speak up when they see something as potentially dangerous. So what did we do? We launched a petition that 4,000 people signed, and LAPD shortly thereafterward announced new de-escalation training for police. We asked for there to be a conversation about firearms and a town hall meeting about police violence, and that did eventually occur. We created power and purpose among residents, which we utilized for other things, like obtaining funding and recruiting underrepresented minorities in medicine, staging a walkout for equal wages. This power was built from realizing that we could come together and fight against a policy we found to be unjust. And you know what? They started respecting us. There was never any formal justice for Reuben. No criminal charges were filed, but a civil case was. And I got the opportunity to testify, as did other healthcare providers, to tell Reuben's side of the story the best we could. And his mother was awarded $3.5 million, likely because our voices carried weight. Even more importantly, as her lawyer later told me, and actually she personally confirmed to me, for the first time, a little bit of pain was taken away. For the first time, someone from the inside said, your son, his life, it was worth something. And he did not deserve to die. Not like this. He is not the reason he is dead. We are. We are responsible for everything that happens inside our hospital walls. The world is going to bring things that define it with each patient that enters. Patients who face discrimination will have worse health outcomes. Bias and racism will continue to influence police, and this will continue to lead to disproportionate violence against communities of color and to police shootings. And while in another talk I'd like to convince you that those things that happen outside our hospital are also within our reach to change, certainly what happens inside our hospitals is. We need to start speaking up. We need to stop being silent, and we need to stand with one another in the process of doing that. What I did, it was not heroic. It only appeared that way because literally no one else was standing with me. And what happened to me? I still got the fellowship I wanted. What they told me to fear, everyone told me to fear career suicide, it never happened. Partly because of privilege. And yeah, while some people continue to dislike me, I'm cool with that. If that's what it takes to protect patients and give Reuben a voice, I'll do that again and again and again. I hope in the future you guys will all be standing with me. Thank you.